Blog Talk Radio.
What's the topic? We'll never run out of options. Fatherhood to justice, O'Shea and Mark dropped the knowledge. These are times where we try for a peace of mind, organize and then reignite with these words from the other side.
We're two good brothers, unpacked. Meaningful conversations centered in solutions that transmute the systemic energy of being black in America, where each episode is packed with inspirational messages and thought-provoking special guests. Come join us on the other side.
The views and comments expressed do not reflect the opinions of eWater Radio. All comments and views are show guest views and comments and in no way reflect views or comments of eWater Radio, KEWR-DB, or its affiliates.
You're listening to eWater Radio, KEWR-DB.
Welcome, welcome back, everyone. So good to have you back here on the other side. It seems like so much happens in between the time that we have to spend together. So we don't want to waste any time because there's some things that we want to talk about. But before we jump into that conversation, as always, we want to hold space for our brothers and sisters who continue. Their struggle for freedom, justice, and equality, to continue their struggle for equity in policing and with the legal justice system. So we want to continue to hold space, and we want to remember, even though you may not see a hashtag floating around, even though you may not see something being prevalently discussed on the news, doesn't mean that there's still the struggle has ended. So we want to continue to hold space for that. And additionally, we want to hold a great deal of space and prayers for our brothers and sisters over in Haiti. There was a tremendous earthquake, and to date, over 2,000 men, women, and children have lost their lives. Unfortunately, that has not had the press that it should have garnered, and so we want to make certain that we hold space in remembrance for our brothers and sisters over there. Do I have my partner Knowledge on the line, Brother O'Shea? Are you there,
Brother Mark? I am here on the other side. Just really glad and grateful, man, to be here, man, to just be on this radio program with you, brother. And just thank you for always, you know, holding space for, you know, the many that we continue to lose in the physical realm, but they do become ancestors that can still shift the tides while we're still in this dimension. So we give thanks and gratitude to all of them.
Absolutely, brother. And that's an important fact to remember. Just because someone is no longer physically in our presence, it doesn't mean that their energy is gone. And whatever ceremonial way we connect to our ancestors, we should definitely be doing that right now during these times, because it is a tremendous moment that we find ourselves in. And so I thank you, brother, for bringing that point to our attention, our ancestors. And it's important, again, to connect to them. That's very important.
Yeah.
Lastly, we want to hold space and keep our attention on what's going on in Afghanistan. As we know, after 20 years of being over there, American troops are being pulled out, and it is chaotic at this moment. And the future of liberties and agency of women over in Afghanistan is in question again. Those who helped America in the hopes of having what they consider to be a democracy, their future is in jeopardy right now, because there's many who are not able to get out. So we want to continue to hold space for them as well and pray for peace. I mean,
yeah.
I'm a praying man, brother. I believe when there's a collective energy that reaches the within the universe, things change. I'm also a man of action. So I get up off my knees, my prayer rug, and then I try to, you know, do things to help bring about a better world. And I know you and your amazing wife, you both do the same, brother.
Absolutely, man. And this is a time that we must pray for peace on earth and throughout the universe. And then at the same time, we know that the balance is chaos, because how can one have peace if one do not have, you know, chaos? So it's a balance. Mm-hmm. And with that being said, you know, the scale seems to be tilted more in the chaotic fashion. That's why we need brothers, families, and, you know, light workers, light beings to continue to pray for peace so we can balance this energy out.
Beautifully stated, brother, and that's true. So we definitely want to remember that. And we speak about balance. I think that's a good segue into our conversation today. We're going to be talking about going back to school. The joy and anxiety of going back to school. And we have with us, who's going to be sharing this hour, a wonderful human being who's been in the educational field for at least 10 years. She can correct me when she comes on, but her name is Stephanie Telez, and she is an educator and advocate for equity in public education. Stephanie, are you with us on the other side?
I am. I'm here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. First thing I want to know is, what do you do in the capacity as a advocate for equity in public education? How are you helping the babies in that capacity?
So for the last, right before COVID, I finished up my 14th year as a classroom teacher, special education teacher with early childhood students, and so first to five, I really had the babies before they made it to elementary, and providing community support and programs and access for many parents who didn't know how to access special education needs for their children in programs. And along with that, I got really involved with the teachers union and realized that on the national level, we really need to be talking about equity across the country in education and what that looks like. And so I was part of basically curriculum development for the National Education Association, and we went around the country and talked about equity in classrooms and what that looks like in Ohio versus Oklahoma versus California, and even states like California that talk about how progressive we are, the challenges we still face, as we know that many children, their education basically is dependent on their zip code, and that's what we're fighting, that everybody has equity and access to what they need.
Now, for those who are listening, Stephanie, when we say equity, when you say equity in the classroom, give some examples of what that looks like. I know it differs, like you said, from Ohio to California to New York to Memphis, because it differs. It differs, but then it's the same in some respects. So can you flesh that out just a little bit? When you say equity in the classroom, what does that look like?
So what we have to first realize is equity and equality are not the same thing, right? And so we think about equality, everybody getting the same thing, right? So we look at curriculum is all the same, access to books is the same, and the same tech. When you think of equity, you think about where are students currently functioning at, not just academically, but socially, emotionally, and what needs do they have? Do certain schools and districts need more counselors or more social workers or different programs at the high school level? Are we providing enough tutoring? Is there enough tech, not just in the classroom, but is the infrastructure in that community, right, when we think about rural parts of the country, do they have the access to actually use the computer that we may send home as districts, right? Like, what good does it do me to send a student home with a Chromebook, but they have no internet? So you think of programs, certain cable companies, and we saw this during COVID, started giving free cable and free internet service to families who either couldn't afford it, or they started having, we actually saw some states have school buses with hotspots that would park in neighborhoods so students could actually get onto their program. You talk about the curriculum. Do the books have characters that reflect the children in the community, right? Can I identify with the story as a student? because we talk about representation matters, and it really does, especially in those primary grades when we're first teaching children, you know, reading and writing and math skills. They need to be able to relate to what they see.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we talk about feeding children. Are there food programs where they're needed? I mean, it's not just making sure they have the academic curriculum and books, but everything else in their life that makes them just a human being and what they need.
So who are the players? who are the advocates, and where does this play out? I mean, I know at school board meetings, but is it a mix of parents and teachers together, or are these professionals like yourself? Who are the players in this, Stephanie? And on what is it at City Hall where these things are discussed, at school board meetings? Where are these discussions taking place?
Well, ideally, you would hope that it would be a mix of stakeholders. So you would have community partnerships, you would have parents, caregivers, guardians, you would have teachers, school nurses. You would encompass everybody in these conversations. But a lot of times what we see is that school board members tend to be the ones making decisions for school districts, right? They're elected by the community. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when we look at certain communities, especially Black and brown neighborhoods, we don't have a large turnout of voters. And so you tend mm-hmm. to have, in some areas, you know, name recognition. And so, you know, the veterans in the community tend to be ones who vote, not so much the younger folks. And mm-hmm. they elect board members. And the board members, depending on where you are, can be amazing, right? They could be engaging. They can create opportunities for communication with the community. And then you can have board members who do what they think is best, and that's it. But ultimately, the people power is where everything is. And if we had the community involved and actually saying, this is what my child needs, those elected officials would have to comply. And so it takes a village. You know, I know that yeah. sounds cliche, but it really does take everyone to yeah. be involved.
And here's the thing, and I think this is what a lot of people, not a lot of people, but many people in the electoral process that they miss, because we have a lot of attention that's on the national elections and even in the midterms, that's less than the national. But these local elections that take place, like for school board members and prosecutors and police chiefs, those elected officials who make decisions about our everyday lives, people on city council boards, we don't show up. We don't show up.
Right.
Two places. We don't show up. And then those who do show up, sometimes we don't continue to show up to hold them accountable.
Absolutely.
So,
that is a huge problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I would say, so
what
are
you guys doing? Let me ask you this. What have you guys done, and what sort of conversation have you guys had to address that issue?
So I think you have to be mindful of a couple of things. You're fighting in the classroom, and I'll speak as a teacher right now. You're fighting with, you can't be political, but then you're also mm-hmm. fighting with everything is political, right? And so mm-hmm. there's only so much a classroom teacher can do while they're at work, right? So mm-hmm. I can't go and say, hey, this candidate is who you should be voting for because this is how they support your child. But what I can do as a classroom teacher is say, hey, did you know that there's a school board election coming? Here is a flyer of all candidates. Here's where you can go vote. I can't, you know, endorse anybody as an individual. However, after school, I can do what I want to do. So if I stand outside of a school ground off campus, right, off district property, I can organize other teachers to say, this is a school board candidate we endorse. I can wear a shirt. I can have a sign. And I can go door to door and educate the community. As a teacher, I spent a lot of time canvassing for certain school board members, candidates, because I knew what they were doing was right. And what's hard is that money at election time is crucial, because a lot of people who run for certain positions, and school board in particular, they use school board to get to city council or some other so-called higher position. And so they have all this money, and they're not really invested in that school district, right? It's just a stepping stone.
Mm-hmm.
So you have
it's
to really vet that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You have to vet people. You have to really know where they come from. And you have to know who else endorses them and who's giving them money, right? Follow the money. If you go online, FBP, you can look at any candidate's financial documents. Anyone can pull it up. You can see who's giving them money. And so that's important when we think about Biden Brown neighborhoods, right? You think about why isn't the school board doing what I think is best as a parent? Well, let's look at who's endorsed these candidates. Let's look at what organizations they're tied to, right? So are they really here for children, or are they here to make money? Or are they here for a greater title, you know, in their mind? Because in my opinion, there is no other greater position than to be a school board member that can truly help shape a community and work with the community to help those kids.
Absolutely. Stephanie, this is Brother O'Shea. First off, I just want to say, you know, just, you know, salute and give thanks for you and the type of work that you've been doing, you know, especially under, you know, under grade school before they come in and you have them and you're cultivating and nourishing them. That's major. You know, I taught at the Watts Learning Center for about 10 years, fifth and sixth graders, and I build curriculums for charter schools. I'm saying that because I notice a really big gap in, you know, the parent, the teacher, and the school board relationship. By the time they get to the parent, it's a mistranslation, like they don't know what's going on. And the child is so confused. So my question is, what type of steps you feel that the home can make to even be more in a seamless line with what's happening in school? Because it seems like it's a great big gap.
That's a great question.
So I think there's a lot of things we can do. Number one, I think we have to, as a district, we need to go to the community. I think that's first. So making opportunities, whether that's through community centers, local organizations, to hold meetings where parents can come, that the time does not conflict with their work schedule. Because if we're going to really, truly care about what parents think and what they need and their input, then we're going to be available to them. But as parents, if there's an opportunity, I have to, as a parent, take ownership and responsibility and show up. And not just bring myself, but bring my neighbor next to me, right?
Yes.
Bring, hey, so-and-so, I know we're busy, but my oldest can watch our kids. Let's go. Because if we don't prioritize being involved, people get to make decisions on your behalf. But if you want to be in control, then you have to show up. And you don't get to be mad if you don't show up and the result is not what you want. And so I think a lot of times, you know, I hear parents say, you know, when I was in the classroom, you know, Ms. Tejas, you make me feel welcome. Or Ms. Tejas, thank you for being available for this after 5 o'clock call. And as public school teachers, we have to own the fact that it is our responsibility to be available to parents. Now, I'm not saying all hours of the day and every weekend. However, if I have a parent who is trying to be involved, I can't just say, it's 2:30, I'm done.
Right?
I have to fight. I have to really fight and say, you know what, can you email me? Can you catch me on my way to work in the morning? Maybe I have a 7 o'clock conference call, right? But that's something that has to be cultivated by individuals. But as parents, come preschool and kinder, I need to reach out to the teacher, right? I need to pick up the phone. A lot of educators have, you know, remind apps and email and all this tech, right? And so we need to be able to say, look, and if it's a translation issue, right, like we have a lot of non-English-speaking families, then we need to make sure districts are providing translators and opportunities for meetings to be held in two or three languages if necessary.
Yes, absolutely.
Stephanie, what's the disconnect? Because I know that these messages, I know, you know, the work that O'Shea's done in the educational field, I know the work that you're continuing to do, and I know and teachers have spoken about the importance of parents being involved at school board meetings, PTA. What's the disconnect? Why hasn't that become the cool thing or the hot buzz button thing to do? I mean, why are parents have not engaged yet? What's missing?
I mean, I think
Well,
I think, number one, we have to look at the makeup of educators across the country. 70% of educators in America are middle-aged white women, right? And so 70% of the students are not white students, right? So
right,
if you think
right.
about our black students and our brown students and our indigenous students, we need to make sure that our teaching staff reflects that, because how does
Absolutely.
It feel if I'm a parent in a predominantly black neighborhood and I come to talk to my child's teacher and that teacher talks to me and I don't understand what they're saying, or I feel uncomfortable because that teacher, somehow you can feel when someone, you know, is talking down to you or questioning your parenting style, right? And so if I'm a parent who is kind of ostracized, why am I motivated to be involved? I love my child, but every time I go to the school, I don't feel welcome, or I'm looked at in a certain way, right? That there is this assumption that I am, oh, you know, she's the angry mom now, or she's, you know, there's a lot of things that happen that we need to support and provide, you know, better opportunities for engagement. But on top of that, you have to think of, when you look at predominantly white districts, when parents in affluent white neighborhoods don't like something the school board does, you know what they do? They show up. Not only do they show up, they tell the board, you will not win another election. And then they go to the neighbors, don't vote for him.
Right.
And so
hold
a lot of power because those school board officials want to be reelected. We don't do that as people of color. Right? And so now you see that we do hold a lot of power. There's a whole lot of us out there. We just need to organize and know that although it may be uncomfortable at first or a challenge, that our children are worth it. And that no teacher, no public school system should stop us from being involved.
That's such a really a crucial point, because I listened to this show. I don't know if it was NPR. It was a program that they had about white parents in New York and how they basically controlled the school district. And it was exactly what you said, Stephanie. It was them organizing, going to the school board meetings, letting the school board know that you are beholden to us, not the other way around. And if you want to sit in this nice building.
And you hold them accountable when things go wrong. And we got to remember, look, school board members are human beings. They're going to make mistakes. But if they listen to the people and they make a mistake and they try to fix it and they go, you know, we acknowledge that that probably wasn't the right policy, and they do fix things, then that's, you know, a way to work with the community. And I don't expect anyone to be perfect, but our parents have to show up. And it can't be the same 10 parents every time.
Right.
It's got to be all of us. You know, if we want to really provide what we think is best for our own children, then we have to be their voice. And one thing I'll say that has been really remarkable, especially during COVID, especially if you look at like LAUSD, the amount of student voice that is now out there, these young people have come up and realized that, number one, technology is their best friend. So all these Zoom school board meetings and everything going on, they can show up. And number two, they are great at organizing their peers to show up. And so we need to look to the young people to say, what do you need? What do you need from us as adults? We don't have to lead it all. A lot of times we have to support them. And that support can look different ways.
If you look over the years, it's been young people from the civil rights movement to Black Lives Matter to the Black Panthers. All these were young people, right? They were young people fueled by the desire to see change. And so I just wish there was a way to make the school, the interest of our children in school as sexy as Black Lives Matter, right? So people can organize around that.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many opportunities. You look at Students Deserve out of L.A., and you look at other Instagram posts when it comes to student-led organizations and Facebook mm-hmm. and all this social media stuff, they actually do have a good following. Now, mm-hmm. how do we get, I think if you look at, like, teacher unions, right, how do we get the teacher unions on board? How do we get them to support these same students? And understanding that teachers have a fine line. I understand that you're going to have members who, you know, their politics are going to really forbid, make them feel like they can't participate. But how do we really look at just what do students need and stop making this about, you know, I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat. It needs to be about the students. Mm-hmm. And if we keep it student-focused, I mean, you can't go wrong if you're doing what's best for kids.
Right, right.
You know, that's
one of the things I wanted to So I wanted to add one of the things, Mark, to that question is, you know, one of the things we focused on was creative equity, you know, rallying mm-hmm. the students around creative projects, you know, that have purposeful messages. And we found that, you know, they're so creative and they want to just jump in and create. However, the school does not, nine times out of ten, the curriculum does not lend itself to students thinking for themselves and creating. So when you're creating, you're able to be conscious. When you're not creating, mm-hmm. your subconscious is running the program. So a lot of educational systems, they're putting programs in our students and not allowing them to think for themselves. So I'm saying that if we can rally more schools like we were doing around creating positive, you know, messages through creativity, oh, my God, like, watch out now, you know, but oftentimes you don't want, or I'm not saying you don't want, but the system is not set up for a large number of students to think for themselves.
You're right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to turn our attention to back to school. And what's happening there? Because it's a new reality that we are going into with our children going back to school in the midst of still a pandemic, and now a pandemic that has brought forth a variant. I think two variants, and one that is predominant right now is the Delta variant. And so, you know, I think there's a broader conversation, nationwide conversation, you know, about mask and going in back to school. And I think most of the states, out of the 50 states, I think there's probably two or three, like Florida, Georgia, I think Arizona, the legislators banned the mask, but then the school board overrode that and they allowed this, to, you know, they said that in all 32 of the zip codes that they have to wear the mask there. So when we talk about going back and this, you know, the subject of joy and anxiety, let's just talk about, like, specifically, we deal with California because that's where all three of us are from and we're actually, not from, but we're actually here. What have you found, Stephanie, and the atmosphere or the added, not the added atmosphere, but I use that word, the atmosphere about how people are feeling, how teachers are feeling, how students are feeling, parents are feeling about going back into school right now?
There's a mix of feelings depending on where you are and who you talk to, but you have a lot of students who are just happy to be back to, you know, their so-called normal life pre-COVID. You have a lot of teachers who are happy to be back in the classroom. You have parents who I know are thrilled to be back. but then you also have...
Did you say parents?
You have as a parent, yes, I am one of the thrilled ones. But you do also have a lot of anxiety over, you know, the state of California, basically the governor mandated that all schools have to go back in person. Now, should a parent want to do not feel safe yet or comfortable, then they can do an independent study. And many districts are not promoting their independent study because they rather have the kids in the classroom. But,
That's not virtual.
Yeah. So it's not virtual. Independent study is, depending on what district you're in, you know, you go in, you pick up a packet, you may meet with the teacher for a little bit. And then they do have some virtual opportunities for folks. Now, that's all going to depend on where you are. Some are county-led because districts are not mandated to do that. But you do have, you know, I had a couple calls today of people who are really nervous. They've already had COVID cases. I know, you know, I happen to live in Orange County, and I got an email last night. It is the second day of high school for my oldest, and 14 COVID cases were reported. Now, those COVID cases, those are students at the school who were not at school yesterday or today, but, you know, you kind of, kids hang out, right? You don't know who was with who, and that, yes, they're doing contact tracing and all of that, but this is day two of school, and we're already getting those emails. But imagine
so
3-4 weeks from now.
What's the protocol? I mean, I know it's not the same in every district, but what's the prevailing protocol when something like that happens? I mean, there's an outbreak. What happens?
So we have to. So outbreak. We can't use the word outbreak because that means they all had it. It was an outbreak from school, meaning some kid A gave it to kid B, and so on.
So what we can say right now,
the state guidelines are: if you are vaccinated and you have no symptoms, and let's say I go to school tomorrow, I've been vaccinated. And remember, only 12 and up are able to get vaccinated. We're talking mostly 7th through 12th grade. If you are fully vaccinated. And you're in close proximity to someone who tested positive for COVID, you do not have to quarantine. However, if you are unvaccinated and the school does contact tracing and sees that you were within 6 feet for more than 15 minutes to someone who tested positive, you then have to quarantine. Now, there it's a 10-day quarantine. However, my understanding is there are certain districts you can do 6 to 8 days if you then have a negative COVID test. So no matter what, you're going to have to quarantine. So what we're seeing, though, is just today I left the site and we have a couple of hundred kids out on quarantine, not because they have COVID, but because they're contact tracing and they, you know, there were, you know, a handful of students who had it. But once they did the contact tracing, it ended up being over 200 children have to be quarantined because they weren't vaccinated. So you got to think kinder, TK through sixth grade. You know, that's going to be a major concern as we move forward because that means my child's at home, and now teachers are not mandated to do virtual school. So depending on what your school district's contract is with the teachers as well as the policies of the district, you may have a child who quarantines 10 days who has no time with the teacher and has to just do packets on their own or follow along on Google Classroom, but there is no longer this mandated virtual instruction.
Oh,
go ahead, brother.
No, yes, Stephanie, I have a question for you. So, like you said, it's no longer this mandated virtual instruction. My question is, what do you feel is the reason why? Because so many parents that I spoke to, they love the option of doing it virtual or taking them to school, having that option. Why do you feel that option is taken away, and what do you feel is going to be the ramifications of that?
Good question.
I think there's a couple of things we have to, particularly in California, as you all have heard about, the Newsom recall, right? So we have a governor who, let's be transparent, who's a little worried about what's going to happen, right? And if we look at California politics right now, what governor would change the policy to put us back to virtual, knowing that many of the people who want him recalled, it's because their kids were forced to be home? So that's number one,
Speak on it, sister,
So let's think of politics. And then you also have to consider when students were home, fortunately, for a variety of reasons, we had many children who did not show up to class, right?
And you spoke about some of those reasons before, not access to having Wi-Fi and some of those things.
Right, and also you have to consider that if parents have to work, and you have two or three children, and you may have elementary-age children or preschool-age children, my middle schooler or high schooler might have to be home to care for these children. And so I can't, if I'm 13 and I'm taking care of my kindergarten-age brother, and I may not be able to log in, right? And I have a responsibility. My family is a priority, right? And so we have to really be mindful that the parents who said virtual was for them, you know, that's great, but we have to figure out how do we have opportunities for all students, and that goes back to equity and focusing on what individual districts need, because every district is unique, right? And then on top of that, if the governor is saying you're going to get funding because you have students in seats as a district, why would I create virtual program opportunities if I'm not going to get the funding to pay for the school, right? The electric bill still has to get paid. The internet bill still has to get paid. Superintendents are expecting a paycheck. Teachers need a paycheck. Your classified staff need. So it's not a simple answer. And we have seen a lot of parents who have decided to go out of public schools and go to charter schools, right?
And
for some parents, that was a choice that they had to make. They felt like that was the best choice for their child. And for some parents, that's not an option.
What are the teachers saying, Stephanie? Because what are the teachers saying? Because I know that, you know, you have these mandates and you have these the reality of funding. I know in Florida, the governor's saying if you don't have masks, you're not getting funding. I know the reality of how funding works, students in the seats, and there's, you know, you get. But the teachers now, the teachers and other, you know, educational administrators, they've become the police now. They have to go in and they have to watch people with masks, and they have to become those who oversee if someone is looking sick or not. And I mean, what are they saying? Are they saying that they, you know, they want a virtual option, or are they saying that they are already stressed out? Because this is a tremendous amount. My daughter is in the eighth grade, and she made a comparison. She said it's like the teachers are like prison guards now. They're running around the yard telling people to put their masks back on and trying to break up groups of children who are not standing 6 feet away. Is there sort of a collective already stressing out of teachers in this early stages of coming back to school, or what are you hearing?
It really does depend on where you are, but what I will say is that in the midst of the pandemic, teachers worked more than they have probably ever had to work, right? And so having summer, many teachers, unfortunately, couldn't take a summer break because financially they have to work summer school to survive, right? And so being mindful that many educators are underpaid and went above and beyond during COVID, they came back, had their little summer, whether it was, you know, 2 months or 2 weeks, and now they're in a classroom situation with ever-changing guidelines, right? So we just had new mandates updated last week for the L.A. County Department of Health. And it's very difficult to get that information out because there's such a mix-up of info. But you have educators who wholeheartedly, Mark, want to be in the classroom and want to be there every day, who feel safe, who've been vaccinated, and who are ready to do their job. And they've missed being face-to-face. And then you do have educators, you have to remember, who have underlying health conditions. You have teachers who work in districts where none of their students are going to be vaccinated because that's the preference of that community.
Yeah.
Right? And you,
so much.
That's a challenge. And if I have, you know, some teachers are taking care of their elderly parents in their home or, you know, so many factors. And so I can't say that one way or the other. All I know is the majority of teachers I talk to are hoping that their 7th through 12th grade students are vaccinated. And most of the pre-K through 6th grade are hoping parents are vaccinated and that parents are not taking vacations. They're truly staying home still as much as possible. But we all know, I mean, look at the airport, right? They're full.
They're full. Oh, my. And then the numbers are rising. And then you think of at the expense of, you know, families. You know, I think of the children at seventh grade and under, you know, just say they can't get vaccinated, but they are still moving around. And then just say if they are carrying something and then come back home to and may have elderly grandparents at the house or whatever. It's a very interesting dynamic. And All, mm-hmm. Yes. I'm like really, you know, just vibrating on sending as much light and love as I can muster out into the universe, because this situation, like the projections, wow. Like, you know, what mm-hmm. are we doing? Repeating 2020 all over again? It's just so unfortunate what people would do to drive for funding, I would say. So unfortunate.
No, you know what? That's a good point, O'Shea. I mean, I think that there's you have the interest of the children, and then you have the interest of the economy, and those two
right.
things are invariably at odds with one another. I mean, the whole push
Absolutely.
To get parents back, to get school going, in the first wave of the pandemic was because parents who did not have child care, there was an issue of them going to work. And so
mm-hmm.
they had to figure out, you know, how can we get kids back in school? So when that conversation first started hitting the landscape, it wasn't in the best interest of the children. Mm-hmm. It was in the best interest of the economy. And then you talk about, you know, teachers feeling safe. I mean, over the summer, teens, the rate of COVID among teens rose five times greater than it was in the spring, or the winter. In the summer, it rose five times because people feel more comfortable in the heat because you think COVID doesn't spread in the heat. So therefore, people are taking off their masks. People are not, you know, either not getting vaccinated, or they are partially vaccinated, or they're not really thinking about, you know, being safe wearing masks. And so the rate of COVID is up five times now in the fall. These kids are going back to school. And so, like you said, Stephanie, in some districts, 200 students had to leave the school for a portion of time because there was an incident. So it's a tremendous thing. And there's a weight of mental health sort of burden on this.
Yeah,
from
absolutely.
The first wave, the second wave, and now the variant. Are there any mental health measures in place Because I know there's been some shifting of budgets from there's not been a complete defunding of police, of course, but I know in some school districts they've taken the police out of the schools. So what's happening with that funding? Is that going towards mental health, helping to stabilize the mental health of the students? Well, what's going on with that?
So obviously it's all going to depend on the district, but currently there's actually been more funding available through the governor's budget for public education, where districts have access to funding for mental health support. And that can play out a variety of ways. You can talk about school counselors, social workers, bringing in outside programs or creating your own programs. It's really going to depend on where you are, but what I would encourage parents to do, if they really believe that their own child may be in need of some type of mental health support, even social emotional skill support, talk to the classroom teachers, talk to your school site administrators, because they're going to be the ones that are going to be able to tell you, hey, we have this program. Yes, I think your child is a good fit and can access these resources, rather than kind of just sitting on it or waiting to see if they can find something they have to pay for. Because most districts have some type of support in place, and some more than others.
Is that information being disseminated to parents? And some sort of handouts, because a lot of people don't know that this exists, other than like school counselors, which is always.
Sure. I think typically when we look at schools, the way wrong, right, or indifferent, but typically the way that type of information goes out is that a teacher sees a need in a student, right? I noticed little Johnny, mm-hmm. you know, isn't himself lately or is acting out. I may then call in the school counselor and say, hey, can you come take a look, come talk to him, may call a parent. But a lot of that is going to rely on the classroom teacher. And so
right.
I think as parents, guardians, we have to do our due diligence to make that contact with the teacher to say, hey, have you noticed any changes? Right, because
mm-hmm.
the teacher's got a room of 30, possibly 40 students. They can't always catch everything. And
they
sometimes
can't always.
Children are
mm-hmm.
right. Children are different for their classroom teacher sometimes than they are at home.
Absolutely.
Right,
absolutely.
And some students
yeah.
are. Some
yeah.
students are great actors. You know, they pretend everything is great. They don't want anybody
yeah.
to know. And then they go home, and you're like, oh my gosh, what happened?
Right.
Right.
Can't that
and
be
so
an assumption?
Very,
be an assumption? I'm going to cut you off, Stephanie. Can't there be an assumption that over the past 16 months that kids were involved in an extremely 100-year sort of event? Last pandemic happened 100 years ago. Can't there be an assumption that every student stepping in that building has a mental health issue? They're adjusting to a new reality, and let's get paperwork out to know that there's help there, even if they're not presenting as a mental health issue. Is that something that we can advocate for?
You Great could question. Make that assumption, but, I mean, you actually have some kids who were thriving during COVID, who had amazing opportunities, who did such a great job with the virtual schedule and truly enjoyed it, and families were able to be more engaged with their academics because parents were working from home. But I think you have to be careful, because when we advertise programs, there's a limit to the funding, right? And so the reality is that schools are underfunded. Schools in California are underfunded. Schools in almost every state are underfunded. And so I hate to say it like this, but you really want to make sure those that need it get it, right?
Absolutely.
But understanding that there may be only two counselors available, one social worker for an entire elementary school. And so that we shouldn't give access, but what we should be doing as a community is advocating at school board meetings that we need to hire more mental health specialists. As teachers, advocating that we need to hire more and stop hiring some of these positions that, frankly, don't need to be in a school district at all, right? And so you can hire all the reading specialists you want. But if your students on your campus are not mentally prepared and ready to learn, it's not going to matter.
Right.
So we have to really think about
that. And that goes back to school board participation.
Yes.
Going to the meetings and the advocacy. Yes.
Right. So, Mark,
go ahead, brother. Go ahead.
No, Mark. I just wanted to say, brother, first, thank you for inviting Stephanie onto this program, man, because I know so many parents out there are just feeling like, yes, because, Stephanie, I might say you are doing an excellent job at articulating with passion a lot of concerns that parents may have but just really don't know where to ask the question. You're hitting on all these points, so I just wanted to pause briefly to say thank you for that, Stephanie. It's truly appreciated.
We give you a round of applause
welcome.
For
anytime.
That, Stephanie.
anytime. This is fun. Yes. Nobody's ever asked to interview me like this, so I appreciate the opportunity.
So I have a quick follow-up question. So in terms of this school year, 2021 school year, and, being in education and, seeing, what 2020 has presented and now moving through this year, what are some of your concerns? Do you have any quote-unquote projections like, wow, what really is going on? What are we doing? We shouldn't be doing this. Do you have anything that you can share with us that's a concerning thing to you?
Wow, that's a good question. So as an individual, I'm very concerned with the state of our country and how it's impacted public education. I'm very concerned with state funding. I'm really concerned with this push we have of people in here in our great, progressive California, this anti-critical race theory that keeps coming up and how I keep hearing the threat, right? We're teaching white kids not to like themselves. And that is not at all what we're doing. We are speaking truth to power. We are making sure we have accuracy in history, and we're talking about institutional racism not because we want anyone to feel bad, but we want everyone to be aware that we have to change the systems in place if we truly believe this country is going to give equity across all races. And so that for me is there, and I think we're getting lost in the politics a lot of times, and COVID is another thing that, I cannot believe schools will be open for the entire year. Because
Thank
I can see what's happening.
Yeah.
I'm looking at Louisiana. I'm looking at Florida. Those numbers are real. They've been open longer than California schools have been, and we're seeing what's happening there. So my personal opinion is schools are going to have to shut down again. However, because of the political stance we're in with our governor right now and this election and everything, I don't know when that will happen or if it will happen if he is recalled. Wow. We don't know who the next governor could be. And I really hope people in California understand that this election is going to cost millions of dollars if we do a recall. And those that push back and say we want him out, I mean, let's look at the famous words of Mitch McConnell, who we don't all necessarily like or love, but, you know, there are term limits, there, you know, elections matter, right? If we're going to really think about whether or not we should have a recall or not, we really
need to, and that's important. I think we talk about elections. I mentioned that we pay attention to national and sometimes midterm elections like this or political moments like this. We really need to focus on. I mean, Governor Newsom to me is not a perfect guy. No one is perfect. But when he turned his attention to black maternal health concerns and he said that he wants all, you know, people in the medical field to be trained or to go through, you know, lessons about, you know, how to better serve black women when they come in to the maternal process, I said this is the okay guy for me. And so to now take him out, and it's kind of sad because you see some of the decisions that he's making are directly related to his concerns about being taken out. Because
exactly.
I think as the Delta virus rising, yes, there should be a conversation about, or and there should be a discussion about protocols if we have to go back to virtual learning. But that conversation is not happening now because he's concerned about, is he going to lose his seat? And so that's very political. So we have to move our attention. We have to put some of our energy, some of our attention, some of our focus towards looking at this election because it's such a critical election because you do have people who are vying to get him out, who will, if they get their way, there will not be mandates for masks. There will not be anything. And critical theory is not even practiced. It's not even taught in elementary and high school. That's sort of college-level conversation. That's a college-level class. So, but what happens is, as a lot of people don't understand, is that when you talk about critical race theory and it moves down to these school board meetings or these city council meetings, it's about eliminating, as you said, to anything of discussions of race, anything of discussions of our past that can make certain groups feel uncomfortable about the reality of what actually happened. So we have to be cognizant. We have to stay vigilant and say, look, this is the future of our children who are our future. So if we leave them in the wilderness now, if we back off, if we are too unfocused because of all the things that we're going through, and we're all going through these things, if we don't focus on these critical moments like the recall, then we're going to find ourselves in a much more difficult situation. I get off the soapbox.
That was good.
Because I'm concerned.
That
about
was really
that,
good.
You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah. That was
time
good.
Goes
Mark.
Fast. Thank you, brother. We got
so
8 minutes
fast.
Left. it goes by quick. We got 8 moments. I do want to ask this one last final question. There was, as you mentioned, there was a lot of students who missed out. High school students, probably 40 or 50% didn't show up for classes. In middle school as well. Some people thrived. My daughter got on the honor roll, but that was not the norm, right? So what measures are in place to make up for the lost time? Was there anything in place or is it just like we're starting from where we are?
Wow. I would love to tell you there are all these opportunities and programs in every single district, but again, it's going to be district specific. But I know there are districts that are offering tutoring programs and opportunities for after school help. However, the reality is most of our students are just going to go to school like they did before COVID, and teachers are going to have to do differentiated instruction, and they're going to really have to look at where students are and the skills they have or don't have. But that's no different than what teachers have been doing for years, and we have to be really careful in how we talk about learning loss, because for many students, this is not learning loss. For many students, this is what's been going on for years when we talk about lack of equity and we talk about the fact that you have 25, 30, 40 kids in a classroom with one teacher. There are districts that should have 20 to 1 from K-3, and they don't.
Right.
So you go to certain districts with enough money, right, with enough affluency and enough ability to navigate school board meetings, and they have 20-1, 25-1.
Yeah.
But we go to other districts. And you also have to be mindful that there isn't full-day kinder across the board everywhere, right? So students, you have one district that has kinder from 8-1, and of course those students are getting more in a year than a student who's only going from 8-11, right? You're getting two extra hours 5 days a week. And so the reality is that many of our students, the inequities we're seeing in learning have been happening for years. We're calling it learning loss, and we're saying all these new terms because of COVID, but this has been happening. And so now that we have attention on it, we need to really reevaluate state mandates and look at bargaining different teacher contracts to decrease class size and also to provide more support in classrooms to give opportunities for parents to be more involved. But that's, you know, again, it all goes back to politics. And until we fully fund public education, especially special education that is underfunded by the federal government, we're not going to see the change we want.
Absolutely. And I want to add briefly that, you know, the as students progress and go to high school and then college, you know, let's not forget in 2021, the debt in America for education is $1.6 trillion. So, you know, and them are the loans. So I'm saying, like, it's just imagine, like, all of them who are now not only dealing with COVID, but dealing with, you know, adding to the debt of, you know, having this loan over your head. It's just so much going on right now. And again, Mark, Stephanie, like, I just appreciate this conversation, because for me, the access to power is through the conversation. And we need to have more of these conversations. Like Stephanie said, in our families, you know, on the street with our neighbors, you know, we all rallying around the conversation, because that's where true power resides, in the conversation.
It starts there, brother. It starts with talking about it, understanding the issues, and then once you understand the issues, getting up and then advocating like Stephanie is doing. And here's the thing, if enough people do it, then then you won't get tired. But when you have only a small group doing it, fatigue steps in. And then get people, you know, they pull back, because not because they don't care anymore. It's just that holding that weight by themselves becomes too great, and then it looks like apathy, or they don't care. Oh, you're doing this, but you quit, so you must not care. No, I'm tired. Take the burden from me for a moment, right? So, Stephanie, we got about 2 minutes. We got about 2 minutes left. 2 minutes left. Tell us, you know, just give some encouragement, because I want to end on a positive note. What can parents do to make certain that the future of their children is intact? What can they do in the educational system? Give two, if you said it before, just kind of encapsulate it into like a two or three things that they can do right now.
Be active with your child's classroom teacher. If they're secondary, make sure you contact all of the teachers that, you know, that you feel you need to talk to, depending on your student's needs. More than anything, secondary, meaning middle school and high school parents, you need to be checking your child's grades on a weekly basis. Do not wait till the quarter or the semester to then ask why your child is failing. You need to make sure you're checking. There are too many districts with computer programs and access for you to check on your phone or on the computer or just ask the teacher. And last, really pay attention. School board elections happening this year do matter. And make sure you're asking teachers, you know, what's going on with the school board and who do you support? And ask the community.
Get involved. Talk to your teachers. Make sure you know when the elections are happening. Vote. Do your research. Look at the funding of people who are funding these school board members. All these things, Stephanie, that you've laid out is so important. I hope those who are listening today will take this as their marching orders from General Tellez, right? Are you giving us a marching order? we can't go back and act like we don't know, because once you know, then it's your responsibility. So, Stephanie, we really appreciate you joining us on the other side, enlightening us, educating us, and helping us to understand and giving us some guidance on what we can do to protect the educational experience of our children. We greatly appreciate you. We will definitely ask you to come back, because as the weeks unfold, I know there's going to be new things we need to talk about, things that we didn't necessarily get to cover. But we appreciate you joining us on the other side. And
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
You all
we
have a great evening. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, Stephanie. And we appreciate everyone else that joined us on this show. We're definitely going to put it out. And please join us next time on the other side.
Peace.
Thank you. Peace.